Our meetings are recorded and uploaded to the town's website. I'll now ask for if there's any apologies. I don't believe there are any apologies tonight. Okay. Are there any declarations of interest on items in this agenda, councillors? No? Okay. Item four is announcements. I have several announcements. I would like to acknowledge the fabulous restoration of the Bassendean Hotel by the Art Group. This lovely old dame of a hotel in Old Perth Road will be ready to welcome the hungry and the thirsty from Wednesday onwards. A very special thank you to all the wonderful people who have contributed to this extraordinary labour of love that stands proud in our main street. With over a $7 million reno investment that includes multiple new spaces, courtyards, beer gardens, outdoor bars and a bespoke playground, there is something for everyone to enjoy at this venue. Well worth a visit to soak up the atmosphere and revel in the character of the place, and it's also well worth the wait, I think. I would also like to announce the Power to the People program of events commencing on Saturday the 24th of September, running right through to the 9th of October to coincide with the upcoming school holidays. This is an activation that will bring life back into the Old Perth Road area. It's in partnership with RAC through their Reconnect WA initiative that aims to create vibrant streets and public spaces for people to connect with each other. There will be an assortment of free events, workshops and other activities taking place, and everyone is welcome to attend. To find out the timelines for these events, simply go to the town's website or Facebook page to find event information. Lastly, one cannot forget the legacy of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, who has been an enduring presence in the lives of her subjects. Dedicating 70 years of steadfast service to her people and country, it goes without saying that she was admirable in all respects. God bless Queen Elizabeth II. May she rest in peace. Long live the King. On that, we will move from announcements to petitions. I don't believe there are any petitions. Thank you. And we will now move to public question time. So, or statements. So, I do have... Should we do deputations first? So we'll do the public questions and statements. I do have one statement that was emailed through, which I'll very quickly read. It is from Mr. Phil Burton of 31 Second Avenue, Bassendean. Mr. Burton, I have actually taken a little bit out of this because it was somewhat long. The way we use these laneway corridors and the primary purpose of their use has evolved and will continue to do so. It is arguable as to whether these strips of land have reached their full potential as to what they offer adjoining landowners, the neighbouring and broader community and our urban environment. In their current form and long-held purpose, I believe they have not reached their full potential as parcels of land. What they have to offer for the future is, I believe, unrealised by the broader community, the town, and I have no doubt by some past and current elected members of the town. The importance of these narrow parcels of land is not solely about them, but about what they can provide and activate, create and provide opportunity for neighbouring them alongside. Our typical built form topography in the town is a single house on a single lot, or multi-unit developments on a single lot, all accessed via the primary street. While more broadly, as a city and a nation, we are faced not only with a lack of housing in general, but a lack of diversity of housing types. It is through maintaining these laneways as much as possible that gives rise to opening the doors to new and diverse types of housing topography not yet seen in the town of Bassendean. I'll leave it at that. Now, if you would like to ask a question, I would ask you to come to the microphone, state your name and address, and generally two questions before we move on to the next person. If you'd come to the microphone.
Bell Humphrey, 127A Whitfield Street. I want to ask questions about the draft strategy. And with respect to, firstly, I'd like to know why Jubilee Reserve bushland isn't mentioned in the strategy as a significant piece of bushland. It's not big, but I think it does have significance, and maybe it's just a matter of changing the name of it so that, okay, the main reserve is for sport, but it just seems to be not visible to me in the strategy. So I'd like to know why that can't happen or why that hasn't happened. And what it would take.
If you don't mind, I will refer that to the officer, Mr. Gibson.
Through the chair, it certainly can happen, and if it's council's desire for that to occur, staff can organise that during the week. It's quite inconsequential in terms of the strategy and its recommended outcomes. But if council would prefer to acknowledge the site, it's a reasonably innocuous and immaterial change.
That's great, because I think it's become invisible on the town's landscape because it's not recorded as part of the natural areas, and that's certainly what it's got to offer us. The second thing is, guess what, Bindarin Park. So I'd like to know whether or not the resolution that council adopted in your July meeting with respect to numbers 17, 19, 21 and 23, Anstey Road, has gone forward to the Planning Commission to be included as public open space or local open space in the draft town planning scheme.
Through the chair, not as yet. The reason being is that council is required to now reconsider draft LPS 11, and that is on the basis of some very recent advice from the department in terms of the construct of the scheme. So that will be brought back to council, depending on what occurs, obviously next Tuesday. With the strategy, we would envisage that coming back to council for reconsideration at some point in the last quarter of this calendar year. And from there, whatever scheme council resolves to initiate will be sent forward to the Planning Commission, the EPA and the Heritage Council.
And so does, this is actually three questions now, but does, I think it's relevant to a statement that I'd like to make, which is, does that resolution, is that part of what council will be asked to reconsider or not, reconsidering town planning scheme 11?
Through the chair, the council will be asked to reconsider the scheme. Those four lots and the zoning or reservation of those lots is part of the scheme, so that would be up for reconsideration as well. That's not necessarily the intent of bringing it back to council, because the changes and comments made by the department did not relate to those sites. It was more in terms of, like I say, the construct of the scheme, some of the zones, some of the land use permissibilities. But that said, council will be asked to reconsider the scheme in its totality, and it would be open to council to make whatever decision it considers appropriate at that time.
Okay, I'd like to make a statement about the recommendation that's into the agenda as it's presented for briefing about item 12, where it refers to those lots and doesn't flag that council has already made a resolution about those lots. I think that to have them going out in a published strategy without having flagged that has created and will continue to create confusion and mistrust about the whole process. And I feel not very confident in the democratic process if a resolution that's made 1 month then appears to be being questioned again so immediately and not addressed front on, I suppose. It feels that the tone of that recommendation, I think, feels a little hostile. Now, that to me is, maybe I'm being a bit oversensitive about that, but the things to do with financial impost, need for public open space across the district and financially sustainable aspects of management sort of cast a slur on the intent to take Bindarring forward as a community asset. It's more, I feel like, you know, being made to feel like it's not worthy or something.
So
that's my statement.
Okay, I
not a question.
Okay. This is a forum to tease out some of the details in these reports. So I think that clearly we will ask questions, and certainly we've got community members asking questions on different things. So rest assured, all aspects of these reports are examined during these briefing sessions.
Okay.
Thank you. Do I have any other people in the chamber who would like to ask questions or make a statement? If you could state your name and your address, that would be excellent.
No worries. Sorry I'm late. My name's Jermaine Burke, and here with my husband. We live at 22 Harlan Street in Bassendean. I have lived in Bassendean for all my life. So I was born in Eden Hill, and then my family moved over to the other side of Bassendean, so where my father still resides on the throne. I guess what I wanted to ask was a little bit in regards to the agenda item, specifically 8.1, in regards to the developments of Bindarring Park, and why there may not have been any reference to the July agenda item council decision, resolution, and also the community voice that had happened in the April but also in the July.
I think I will just make a correction there. There's nothing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Gibson, there's nothing in the document that alludes to development of the... You're talking about the Anstey Road blocks.
Rezoning for the purposes of...
So it's about... wording is about rationalisation. It actually doesn't mention development, but I'll actually ask Mr. Gibson to speak to that.
Yeah. Through the chair, that's broadly correct. Obviously, in the report, some effort is devoted to this issue, and the recommended approach is to simply refer to the need to review the zonings and reservations of various lots in that area. And the recommended wording contained in the officer report doesn't fall foul of council's previous decision making on the Anstey Street lots, but simply sets out the considerations that council would need to have regard to when making such a decision.
Okay. And sorry, why is that? Why were there some other points that were referenced in there, but there wasn't the community voice or the July agenda items? Excuse my ignorance here. I'm just simply asking just to help with my understanding on how it all works.
Through the chair, I suppose the prospect of reserving all four lots as open space has not been tested with the community as part of the recent strategy and scheme efforts. Obviously, there's a council resolution from July, I believe it was, and there was some community involved from the very immediate area, but it hasn't been tested with the community at large, and will not be tested with the community at large until such time as we advertise the draft local planning scheme number 11, which may well be later this year or the first half of next year. What has been put in the, or what is recommended to go into the draft strategy, is simply an acknowledgement of the various considerations that council will need to have regard to at some point in the future when it makes at least one, possibly more, decisions on the local planning scheme number 11.
Okay. So, Jermaine, again, when we actually come to that item in the agenda, councillors will... be asking questions about different aspects of, because the scheme is not just Ansara, there are other parts of it. So there will be questions. So if you wish to sit in the audience and listen to those questions, everyone's always welcome to do that. I will just ask, because you've had two questions, I will just ask if anyone else would like to ask questions first. Otherwise, I will allow you one more question if you
Thank
like.
Thank you. Yeah, I did have one more question. So you mentioned the draft local planning strategy or scheme hasn't been out for public consultation. For that particular point, what has gone out for community consultation and how long has that been open for?
Through the chair, we have not gone out to community consultation on the scheme. We have gone out to community consultation for the strategy, and that is the body of work being considered by council tonight as part of 8.1. That was advertised, I believe, from the 22nd of July to the 22nd of August.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, if there are no other questions or statements from the audience, we will move on to deputations. So, we have a chair at the front here. The first deputation is Aaron Lohman. If you'd like to come to the chair, present your deputation, and then if you don't mind, councillors may ask questions.
Sure, thank you. Thank you, Mayor and councillors, for the opportunity. I am presenting two similar presentations tonight on behalf of different clients. Both of them discuss the Eden Hill Centre, so I'll just touch on that in one rather than going through the submissions separately, because the philosophy of the submissions on that particular centre are the same. And I understand you're busy, so I'd like to keep things brief as possible. But the first one is on behalf of Thermos Proprietary Limited, and they're the owner of the Altona Park Shopping Centre, which is in Altona Road, Beachborough. And that, of course, is outside your local government area, but nonetheless, the local planning strategy has the potential to impact on that centre. You may recall some time ago we made submissions on behalf of Altona Park and Hawaiian, which is my second submission in relation to the Eden Hill Centre. We've reviewed the responses to submissions contained within the agenda item, and it's evident that based on the town's local commercial strategy, which was endorsed by the WAPC, and the local economic review, which was undertaken by Farlane to inform the town's economic development plan and ultimately the local planning strategy, that there's limited demand for commercial floor space in Eden Hill at this time. A demand of 366 square metres for 2031 was indicated. So as a rough guide, a convenience store under a local planning scheme was probably limited to about 300 square metres. So it was limited demand for retail floor space. Putting that to one side, at the moment we're aware of the previous concept plan for the Eden Hill Centre that was considered as part of a land transaction in April 2019, and that had a retail floor space or a floor space of 3,840 square metres for a shopping centre, which included 3,200 square metres for a supermarket. In context, 3,200 metres squared for a supermarket is a full line, equivalent to a full line Woolies or Coles or something of that nature. This is noting that there is an existing IGA about 800 metres to the west of the Eden Hill Centre. So at the time, our client had macro plan prepare an assessment of the trading impacts associated with the development of a centre of that particular scale. In our submission, we provided the trading impacts based on that work. So to 2023, so that would have a 21.7% impact on the Kiara. Altona would have 13.8, and Hawaiian Bassendean, it would have 12% of the trading impact. With the latest draft state planning policy activity centres, which we understand has been adopted by the Commission, more than 10% is considered to be a significant impact. We understand at the moment that Eden Hill is zoned and it can allow for a shop use, but it's clear from the the science or the data behind it, at the commercial strategy and in the local economic strategy. There's little demand for commercial retail floor space. And the reporting prepared on behalf of our client demonstrates if it was developed, then there'd be a significant potential for a significant impact on the surrounding centres. In terms of our response, in terms of the submission, there doesn't appear to be in detail consideration of a point raised about the lack of demand for commercial retail floor space and how this might be foreshadowed or provide restrictions on floor space within Eden Hill. Now, this is not to be anti-competitive. This is on the basis of maintaining the existing hierarchy of centres. For example, Hawaiian's Basin Dean is a district centre. It contains a supermarket of 3,000, a supermarket. I don't have the floor space on me. But the size of the local centre is significantly less in terms of its status in the hierarchy. A local centre provides for local needs. What was proposed with that concept plan would be something more of a neighbourhood centre with a supermarket, whereas a local centre would be the day-to-day convenience needs. So there is significant concern that the local planning strategy may facilitate an outcome that's greater than the local centre designation in the activity centre hierarchy. Having regard to the above and given the development foreshadowed by the concept plan, it's appropriate for Council to consider, in our view, and consistent with order and proper planning, to determine the viability of retail floor space within the Eden Hill Centre and impact on surrounding activity centres before foreshadowing a zone in the local planning scheme. Therefore, we ask Council to reconsider perhaps the extent of the local centre zone proposed for Eden Hill and the potential impacts on the hierarchy of existing centres, having regard to SPP 4.2. Thank you.
Councillors, would you like to ask questions on this one?
Thank you. If I remember being here a while ago on the same similar topic, so thanks for being here again. You made the comment that you would like the council to reconsider the extent of the zoning. So what specifically would you like to see there?
Well, the local, I guess that's one option to move forward, given the local economic strategy and the far land work, which was the local economic overview. Is it appropriate to reduce the area of the zone of the local centre to something that would facilitate a development of a smaller size?
So am I right in thinking you're saying the current area that would be zoned for commercial, you'd like to see that scaled back so some of the area would be rezoned for residential or some other purpose? Is that?
That's one possibility. Or council might wish to consider some directional guidance within the local planning strategy about the scale of a future centre on that site, and then that then gets followed through into the local planning scheme.
And sorry, one more question if you don't mind. When you were speaking about the impact on surrounding commercial areas, I may have missed, you may have mentioned it.
Mm.
I got the impression you were talking about that currently it would have that impact.
Yes.
Considering the strategy is a forward-looking future document, mm. and we would anticipate that there's going to be increased development not only in the town but the surrounding areas. With that increase in population that's projected, do you have figures that would give us an indication of what the expected impact would be?
Yeah, the figures that we based are the ones that we did in 2019 for the Eden Hill Centre. Whether there is increased retail density you can zone for it, whether it happens on ground, whether there's take-up, whether there's landowner willingness, is another question entirely. Mm-hmm. So while you might have the projections, whether you actually get that on the ground is another question.
Thank you.
Councillor Plifka.
Yes, thank you. You had advanced two concepts there. One was the demand, and then the other was the impact that, should that demand be realised on the two entities that you represent, the two different shopping centres. Now, if that demand isn't met, so it's zoned in a particular way, and nobody takes up that opportunity, then obviously your clients won't be affected because a shopping centre hasn't been built. But if a shopping centre is built, doesn't that then demonstrate that that demand has been satisfied and that there was that underlying demand?
Not necessarily. I mean, we saw, and it's just outside your border, an applicant demonstrate, attempt to demonstrate by a scheme amendment in Bayswater, an Aldi shop and a service station. Now, that scheme amendment didn't get up, but the work they put forward demonstrated in their minds that there was the retail needed demand for that. It was evident when she did an analysis of that that it wasn't that particular demand. So, look, we don't think there's a retail need out there at the moment, and if that floor space went in, the impact would be as the figures that we have at hand today.
So in terms of demand, you're talking about demand from the consumer as opposed to demand from someone
who would
seek to utilise that commercial space to develop their own centre?
Yeah, the retail demand would be determined by a retail needs assessment.
I just want to understand where the demand was coming from.
Yeah.
Councillors, any more questions? Councillor
Brilliant. Yeah, so the proposed shopping centre that you're talking about is the one on the corner of Morley and Ivanhoe, is that correct?
It's the Eden Hill Centre, yes, it's Morley Drive East, yes.
Yeah. So that you're aware then that the council looked at that being a residential thing as well as shops?
We're aware that the concept plan proposed a shopping centre towards what would be the north of the site, and then I believe from memory that that proposal, that concept plan also proposed residential on the other side, yes.
Mm-hmm. So is it not fair enough that people should have a shopping centre close to where they live, particularly for the elderly who may not be driving anymore? I don't understand. Apart from coming from a retailer's position, I don't understand how your proposal is good for the residents of the town of Bessendean.
Yeah, I'd probably answer that in accordance with the state planning policy. So the state planning policy sets out a hierarchy of centres. So a shopping centre of that size proposed in the concept plan is beyond what is envisaged for a local centre. It's more of a neighbourhood-sized shopping centre. The risk is for council, if the centres get beyond what they're designated for, it dilutes activity and other centres start to struggle. It's a question of, in our minds, is the Bessendean Town Centre, you want to have that invigorated and grow. If you're diluting commercial activity elsewhere, which is contrary to the planning framework, then it might be problematic.
I'll take your word on that. I'd have to have a look at it myself before I could be really convinced. So
sure.
Thanks for answering.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from councillors? Okay. Thank you for your deputation, sir.
Oh, just the one on...
Sorry.
Sorry. I'll be very quick. I'd reiterate the comments regarding Eden Hill on behalf of Hawaiian, who are the owners of the shopping centre at 2 West Road in Bessendean, as you're probably aware, or as it would be aware. Hawaiian are supportive of various elements of the local planning strategy. In particular, increasing the residential population within the town centre is supported, which will add to the vibrancy and hopefully the day and night time economy. The preparation of the precinct structure plan is also supported, and Hawaiian would be keen and would welcome engagement in the preparation of the precinct structure plan. Also creating better accessibility into the Bessendean Town Centre and building upon existing public transport and pedestrian networks would be welcome. We note that the town has prepared the town centre master plan. In our submission, we noted that the outcomes should be reflected in the draft local planning strategy, including elements of residential around Bessendean Oval. We do understand that in terms of Bessendean Oval, as outlined in the submission, that the zoning or the reservation of that land wouldn't facilitate that outcome. But as planning is strategically led, we would suggest it would be important to note for potential future planning, which would inform an appropriate rezoning if required, or when required, that it would be good to note the outcomes of the town centre master plan. And the second issue that I'd like to quickly touch on is the Ashfield District Centre, which is the second district centre within the town. Of course, the district centre is identified in the Commission's central sub-regional framework, and the district centre focuses around the Ashfield Railway Station and surrounds. There's some commercial and retail small-scale development with surrounded by low density. Whilst there is a current district centre designation provided for Ashfield in the central sub-regional framework, there is questionable how two district centres in Ashfield and Bassendean would be sustainable in such close proximity to others, each other, which is 500 metres at its closest point, or if they are to accommodate similar uses. We understand that Ashfield is also proposed to be subject to the preparation of a precinct structure plan. We're not sure where that lies in terms of the priority, but there is concern that the Ashfield District Centre has a limited catchment, given the limited residential catchment, I should say, given the industrial area to the northwest and open space to the northeast. Our client is concerned about the establishment of two district centres would potentially dilute investment in the town centre, which we say is better served by railway stations and is also already the focus of commercial, retail and higher residential development. It's our view that the town centre is yet to mature in terms of the high density population and supporting services, and therefore from a maturity perspective would be appropriate in the first instance to focus on development of that centre and support that centre's ongoing vibrancy. I've touched on the Eden Hill matter, so I won't touch on that again. But in conclusion, Hawaiian Sports of Bassendean Town Centre is a focus of activity and development as the heart of Bassendean. Careful consideration of the establishment of new activity centres such as Ashfield with retail and commercial uses that would dilute investment away from the Bassendean Centre should be seriously considered. A retail needs assessment or impact assessment should be considered in that regard. As previously stated, the local centre zoning for Eden Hill is not supported. I thank Council for their time. Thank you.
Councillor McLennan.
Just a quick question.
Yep.
I'm not sure how closely you followed the draft strategy sort of progress through Council and then lengthy time with WAPC.
Yes.
But you made the comment that in sub-regional framework is identified as a district centre. Given that the feedback that we had on the draft strategy that we originally submitted was basically we needed to align it to what the state government wants, what are you suggesting?
Yeah, I did note that comment in it. I think ultimately there needs to probably be a discussion with the department about that and the
CBLM. I can assure you there's been a lot of discussion with the department.
Ultimately, if you're going to do a precinct structure plan, the structure planning area is going to be defined as part of that process. So that's a next step down the track.
Because that is a challenge for us as well, where there have been quite a number of elements that we have proposed, but there's been, an unwillingness to consider any deviations from what is in the state plan framework, which is, can be challenging for us as well. So, I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Councillor Plifka?
Just picking on the point that you made about maturity.
Mm.
So that, to me, suggests that through the passage of time, it will become appropriate to develop that district centre. What period of time do you envisage that would be, or what would be the other milestones which would have to be reached before it would be appropriate to develop that other district centre?
Yeah, look, I think the tool that you need to use to resolve that question is probably a couple. There's the precinct structure plan. You need to look at demand analysis for what services and facilities are there from a retail commercial perspective, a retail needs analysis, housing demand, etc. So there's a whole suite of documents that would need to inform the precinct structure.
Also, why I informed the view on that, because obviously that would dictate what investment they would put into their centre going forward.
Formed a view on Ashfield?
Yeah, why as to when the town centre would reach that maturity, which would then justify shifting.
No.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, I have a question. Clearly, the creation of the strategy and the scheme is in anticipation of population growth and to accommodate diversity of housing. So there's been no real mention here of the natural forces in play here, but it would be unlikely in the commercial world that a development for more retail space might occur until there is that growth in population. Would you tend to agree with that? Because I would assume that investment in more commercial space would be significant. Would you agree that there might be some natural forces at play here where such development would not naturally occur until you've actually had that general increase in population? And I'm agreeing that it's probably speculation.
Well, not necessarily. Look, I guess in 2019, the proponent came through with a concept plan which showed a significantly larger centre than we would suggest could be accommodated at Heaton Hill. The rationale for that, I'm not 100% sure of. Obviously, they wanted to get some sort of development, and I'm not going to talk about the hows and whys or how they reached that point, because I simply don't know. The natural scheme of things is you would build a centre where there's demand for that particular centre, or you may build it earlier than the demand for the centre and hoping it comes through. It might be evident that a local centre hasn't developed at Eden Hill because simply there's no demand at this point in time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Unless there are other questions, councillors, we should let this gentleman go about his business. So thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Sir.
Thank you.
And I think that concludes deputations.
Correct.
Okay. So with that, councillors, we will move on to the reports. So the first report is 8.1, Draft Local Planning Strategy. So I would ask Mr. Gibson if he would like to speak to this item.
Yes, thank you, Madam Mayor. We've obviously touched upon this through the deputations and the comments and the statements, but nonetheless, the purpose of this report is for Council to consider the draft local planning strategy in light of the recent public consultation that was undertaken. Cutting to the chase, it is recommended that Council adopts the draft strategy subject to various amendments that are listed in the officer report. As councillors are aware, the strategy was advertised for public comment in July and August, which resulted in 35 community submissions. The most common issue raised was in relation to the land around Bindarring Park and the desire for residents living in the immediate area for certain lots in that location to be reserved as local open space. That matter is discussed in reasonable detail on pages 8, 9, 10, 11 of the agenda. And it is recommended that the draft strategy is amended so as to not be so specific in relation to a number of the sites, particularly given Council's previous decision regarding the Anstey Road lots has not been tested with the broader community, as I said before. It's important to note, however, the recommended change to the strategy does not constrain any future decision-making with respect to the Anstey Road lots. It simply states that the zoning and reservations should be reviewed and sets out the various considerations that should influence that review. The report also sets out a number of minor amendments to the strategy as set out on page 14. There will be some more amendments required, but they are all relatively minor and inconsequential, but will nonetheless be addressed during the week and will be marked up in time for the OCM next Tuesday, in addition to the one that we can accommodate for Jubilee Reserve as well. Again, it's recommended the Council adopt the strategy subject to the various amendments, and from there it will be forwarded on to the Planning Commission for determination.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. councillors, I'll open it up to questions. I do have some questions, but I'm just trying to open my page, so if anybody else would like to. Thank you. sorry. I was totally engrossed with my screen that was not doing what I wanted. So I have Councillor Carter's hand up, Councillor Wilding. So Councillor Carter, would you like to go first and then Councillor Wilding?
Mine's just a brief query. The part of the Part 1 strategy appears to be predicated on quite a significant growth in our population. I think you say something to accommodate 24,300 people by 2050. But given that from 2001 to now, we've only had just over 2,000 added, isn't that being a bit ambitious?
Through the chair, I suppose that's a matter of opinion, but quite simply, the state government sets out the dwelling targets, which for the district are 4,150 dwellings by 2050, and this strategy is indeed predicated on achieving that.
Okay. That just brings me to one question. If we don't achieve that, what effect does that have on our planning strategy?
Through the chair, the strategy will still exist. It's not invalidated by not achieving the targets. The targets are just that. There's no legislative repercussions if we don't achieve the targets, and much like the commercial development discussion that was happening before, in many ways it's outside the town's control because it relies on third-party landowners and developers to invest and develop. The town's role and council's role in all of this is to simply set the framework to facilitate that to occur.
Okay, thank you very much. I've got one other question, but I'll wait till after.
Councillor Wilding.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Director Gibson, just for the benefit of members of the public who are coming together now at the very easy interchangeable names and scheme and strategy for the local planning, scheme and strategy, could you just explain the interplay between the scheme and the strategy for those who are coming together in good light?
Through the chair, yes. I suppose without sort of using the term to define it, the strategy is setting the broad, longer-term strategic direction. It's setting council's vision for the district going out to 2050 and beyond, and it's discussing the various elements that make up the town and influence its growth and development going forward. And sets out in reasonably broad terms the various things that the town and council and others should do to ensure, as best as possible, we arrive at the right location 2050 relative to the adopted vision. The scheme, on the other hand, is the nuts and bolts rulebook, effectively. It is sort of operationalising the strategy, and as it happens, the new scheme is one of the major components or one of the major recommendations of the strategy. So if you were to sort of flick through the various recommendations of the strategy, a good suite of them would actually be tied into the LPS 11 process.
Councillor Carter?
Oh, thank you very much. I suppose this one sort of carries on from that. Under the strategy, we would be encouraging infill development. But under other parts that we are going to be encouraging the increasing tree canopy and so on. At the moment, infill development is impacting very strongly on our retention of trees, canopy, vegetation. So aren't these two statements or goals or aims or targets in the strategy at odds with each other?
Through the chair, no, I wouldn't say so. And I suppose the contention that infill development is having a negative effect on our tree canopy is true to some extent, but it's not the sole cause. Council has adopted Local Planning Policy 13, which seeks to remedy the situation as much as possible. That is not proposed to change under the new scheme arrangements. So we would be looking to continue to implement LPP 13, which has been quite successful up until this point. And further with changes to the state planning's framework in terms of residential development and the medium density codes, the state government may actually strengthen its controls. So the the bottom line is that the town is obliged to plan for the future of the district and has been provided a target to aspire towards. That is a non-negotiable. What we can control beyond that is how we protect against excessive canopy loss, and the town is doing a reasonable job of that, not only through LPP 13 and the protection of trees on private property and the provision of new trees on private property, but the work that sort of the other sections, Phil and Nicole to my left, they're doing in terms of our reserves and road reserves, that is also adding to our tree canopy. So the issue of tree canopy is not the sole domain of the private landowner. It impacts the public realm as well, and LPP 13 is playing its part in the broader context.
Can I just ask a question following on from that?
Yes.
Sorry. Just in your recommendation, let me find it, in the table, so it's got the proposed amendments that are numbered. So number five is in relation to the tree canopy, and it's proposed to replace action 4.1 in the strategy that was advertised with support the inclusion of local planning scheme provisions to protect trees. The wording is only fairly slightly different in what was advertised. Is there any significance in the change that's proposed?
Through the chair, I have to take that one on notice just to go back to see. Obviously, the reason provided on the table is to clarify the proposed action. I'd have to go back and assess what the original wording was, but I can provide an answer during the week.
Can I just ask a follow-on question from that line of thought that's going on here? The resolution of council from July that has been spoken about in this chamber earlier tonight by some of the people asking questions and making statements. The last dot point from memory, I haven't actually got it open here in front of me, but the last dot point in that resolution of council related to reducing from 350 square metres to 250 square metres the planting of new trees on a block. I'm just curious about that is relevant to the scheme, which hasn't yet gone out to advertising. I'm trying to actually understand the interplay between that, because earlier in one of your comments you said that the actions from that resolution council have not yet been enacted. So I'm curious about how this interplays with what's before us for this week. Sorry, I just... because they're going out at different times, if you know what I mean.
Through you, Madam Mayor... tonight and next Tuesday, council is being asked to look exclusively at the strategy.
Yep, okay. Councillors, any questions, more questions? Councillor Plifka.
Yeah, just following on from that, so the process that we've undertaken is that the strategy went out for advertising, we got some community feedback. So I suppose to attach that to a concrete example, so we've been discussing 17, 19, 21, 23 Anstey Road. Was there any community feedback that suggested that the community didn't want those lots to remain as public open space consistent with the resolution that had been made in respect of the scheme?
Through the chair, no.
In terms of the amendments, would the amendments generally be responsive to community comment? So where we put a strategy out for advertising, so we're essentially saying to the public that we're satisfied with the strategy. So I suppose, save for obvious errors, slight misdescription of a street name or something like that, would you usually see, I suppose, more substantive changes unless they were community driven?
Through the chair, from time to time, obviously each in its own context, but it may well be that a local government or a council wanted to test an idea and wanted to see if there was any major support or opposition to it, or it just may well be that the environment has changed in terms of the framework. It may have been that a state government department provided some advice late in the piece. that wasn't able to be accommodated previously. So there's all sorts of different reasons for making changes, and I suppose we've tried to go through on page 14 there to give a brief descriptor of what prompted the change. Obviously, the major change that's being recommended is identified there on page 16. That was, I suppose, really to address the concerns raised through the consultation period and some other discussions that staff have been having with council regarding other matters that have probably sit beyond the local planning strategy but are nonetheless quite important. And like I said earlier, nothing in that change falls foul of council's previous decision making on the matter.
No, I accept that. I think your other comment that you might confirm was that whilst those factors to be considered that are listed there, that's simply all they are, that a future council would not be bound by that. If we were of the opinion, we have, I suppose, evidence that council felt a particular way, given that we know that as of July there was a particular position, would we be able to remove that sort of amendment and just simply then rely on the strategy? And if somebody wanted to agitate in respect of the strategy, that would be something which would be open for them to do without, I suppose, that invitation to do so being embedded in the strategy.
Through the chair, certainly. This strategy, it won't get to the Planning Commission until it's adopted by council. So council needs to be satisfied that it sets the appropriate strategic direction for the district. It can be more open and less committal, or it can be far more specific and targeted. Staff have tried to strike the balance between the two, particularly for the Bindari issue. But if council wanted to be far more targeted and specific, it would be open to council to adopt that view via the strategy, and it would ultimately be one for the commission to determine.
I suppose just finally one final question in relation to the town planning scheme 4A. So we got those four lots. We had a discussion about those in July. Do we know how those lots came to be in the ownership of the town? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a register that shows us when we acquired those, or do we have to rely on land gate information to say these properties were acquired by the town at this point in time?
Through the chair, probably the latter, but that's able to be pursued. I don't have the information here and now, but could certainly try and find it during the week.
So we could work out whether funds that have been collected from the 4A scheme were applied towards purchasing those lots?
Through you, Madam Mayor, I'm not sure. We'd be able to hopefully identify when it was purchased, but the machinations of how the town funded it at the time, I'd probably have to defer to Mr. White, but given the passage of time, it may not be all that.
If we are in the realm of inference, though, would it be fair to say that the town planning scheme in 1980 or thereabouts, Great Flood 1982, acquisition of property a few years later, then pretty good chance that it was done pursuant to the town planning scheme 4A?
Through the chair, that's certainly a possibility.
Sorry.
No.
Thank you.
Councillor Carter?
I can probably answer that. There's a fair bit of information about the formation of the 4A scheme, how it has operated, the changes of it over time.
Councillor Carter, how about we allow the officers to pursue that information and to provide it before the OCM, and then if we can actually have some discussion about that when that information is provided.
All I'm saying is that there's plenty of information in our local history collection on that. You won't need to probably go to Landgate and do all of that extensive search when the information is already in our town, as far as I'm aware.
Okay. So could I ask a question as well? There's been the attachment has summarised versions of the feedback, and I'm wondering, because it was raised with me both on the phone and in an email, I'm wondering if there is the potential to provide those to councillors?
Through the chair, yes, we've already consolidated that, and it just was completed a bit late in the day, but that can be sent out first of all.
That would be good. Thank you very much for that. Councillors, are there any other questions on this item?
I was just going back to the canopy aspect. Do we have any reason to believe that the WAPC wouldn't be supportive of our measures to venture into private property?
Through the chair, yes, we do have reason to believe that. Based on some very recent advice from the department, which would obviously form the basis for a future report to council in the last quarter of this year. The provisions that were sort of taken from LVP 13 and proposed to be embedded into the scheme, the department has suggested they be taken out and left in the LVP, which is probably not too harmful, and still provide council the ability to reduce the tree per area ratio if it so chose. But more broadly, obviously, in the terms of the definition of development and trying to control trees more broadly, they've unsurprisingly suggested that would not be possible, but have supported the retention of the tree preservation order type provisions. They want it sort of moved across into a significant tree register, which is largely semantics and still achieves the same ends as the TPOs. Under a slightly different title. So it's looking likely that the town will still have TPOs or equivalent. It'll still have its LPP 13, and that would be the extent of its ability to control trees on private property.
With WAPC in doing that, is that the expectation that there will be legislation that might more fully relate to canopy? Or is there any political appetite to... preserve our canopy?
Through the chair, not in the discussions we've had. We've not been made aware of any impending changes to the definition of development in the Act.
Thank you.
So it'll be subject to another report, so I won't ask that question. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, councillors, before we move on? Okay. Thank you for that. On that note, we'll move on to item 8.2, draft local planning policy, rights of way. Mr. Gibson, again, you're quite the centre in most of these reports today.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. The purpose of this report is for Council to consider its policy settings in relation to development and subdivision abutting rights of way. Those rights of way are scattered throughout the district. Council considered the matter in June and resolved to adopt the draft policy for the purposes of advertising. That advertising occurred and the town received 15 submissions, with the submissions raising various issues including the costs of upgrading the relevant rights of way, as well as the potential for road widening. These matters, as you can see, are discussed in the officer report. Ultimately, it's recommended the Council adopts the draft policy, including the various modifications as identified in the attachments. If it does so, staff will continue to progress draft designs and cost estimates for the relevant rights of way and bring back a subsequent report to Council to enable it to consider the financial contribution required from abutting developing landowners.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Councillors. Questions?
Councillor
Ames?
Yeah, I'll speak. Thanks, Madam Mayor. Through you to Director Gibson. Obviously, there's a range of different types of ways in which these rights of ways, as you identify, will be upgraded, updated, and those costings will come back to Council to approve. If Council don't approve those particular costings based on what the recommendation is, that rights of way, what happens then?
Through the chair, that would be potentially problematic. In that it would effectively be contrary to Council's adopted right-of-way
That's
strategy.
Right, right.
But with the information that Council would then have, Council may choose to revisit the strategy. Because, understandably, if the cost was deemed to be excessive or prohibitive to development, Council may want to consider its alternate options, and that might take you back a step to reconsider the recommendations
right.
in the right-of-way strategy, which
right.
is which is quite acceptable.
Okay, good. No, okay. And obviously there'll be opportunity to potentially downgrade or go sideways in regards to, you know, the particular upgrading or development of those rights ways.
Through the chair, sort of the draft designs and costings are being done through the infrastructure area, based on almost a template approach of what we'd expect for curbs and bitumen and lights and drainage. It would be open to council once it knows the cost to do a number of things. One would just be imposed that on the abutting landowners on a proportionate basis. Council could choose or not choose to subsidise it. Council could choose to de-scope the upgrades. Obviously, that would depend on some expert engineering advice as to how much you could de-scope it before it becomes problematic. Or it could review the strategy entirely and seek to change some of the recommendations from retention and upgrade to closure.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor
McLennan. So, Mr. Gibson, just following on from that question, I still feel like I need some clarity to understand how that would actually work, given that there are some properties that are already developed that Blind Citizen wouldn't be required to contribute, and that properties would only be asked to contribute as development occurred. I'm unclear how the process then would go, when we make the decision to do the upgrade.
Through the chair, that's all correct, those contentions. Council of the town would likely have to make a decision at some point to upgrade a right of way before it has collected all the funds, because it would be problematic to wait until the end point, once you've collected all the funds, which could be decades, if ever, at which time the contribution that you received first has devalued such that can't actually pay for the body of work and the cost escalation. So there's going to be a sweet spot there, I suppose, where we've collected enough funds, which would need to be supplemented with muni funds, upgrade occurs, and then the town would collect after the fact to effectively reimburse itself for assisting the funding up front. So
yeah,
it is there will be some sort of value judgments to be made, but in terms of working out the contribution per landowner, staff would need to assess what development has already occurred, what development is likely to occur, because there's no point factoring in all these lots abutting the right of way if we're never going to receive a contribution, because that artificially decreases the per lot rate.
Mm.
But it may well be, going to Councillor Ames's point, is that if too many properties are excluded, the rate becomes quite high and arguably prohibitive. So there's going to be still some value judgments to be made by council in terms of setting an appropriate figure for the fees and charges, but that will be based on the detailed advice and designs that are prepared.
And is that amount, is that able to be scaled? So somebody, you know, set, say, $1,000 this year, but in 20 years' time, could the council of the day say it was $1,000 then, but then based on inflation and so on, it's now this much?
Through the chair, that would be typically what happens, because it's embedded into the fees and charges. You would ordinarily apply an index year to year, because council would have to adopt that rate every single year through the annual budget and the schedule of fees and charges.
Perfect. Sorry, my second question is, on page 20 of your report, you said that it is therefore recommended that approval be sought from WAPC for clause 6.4A of the draft policy to amend clause 5.3.5 deemed to comply provision 5.1. Could you please explain what that means?
Please. Through the chair, I'll try my best. So as councillors would be aware, the R codes provide two assessment pathways, a deemed to comply pathway and design principles pathway. One's fairly quantitative and one's fairly qualitative. But for single houses, if a proposal meets all the deemed to comply, they are typically exempt from the requirement to obtain development approval.
Yeah.
And therefore, they sidestep the planning system, they don't lodge an application for development approval, they lodge a building permit, and that's it. The issue, the interaction between rights of way in the town and the R codes, is a lot of them are unconstructed. Now, as you can see from the screenshot there, halfway down page 20, the deemed to comply only requires you to use the right of way for vehicle access if it's adequately paved and drained. So if it's not adequately paved and drained, there is no obligation for thought it means a landowner can have their new driveway fronting the primary street. Mm-hmm. They don't have to have any interaction with the right of way because it doesn't meet the threshold. And if they don't lodge an application for development approval, and neither do they use the right of way, there is no prospect of getting a contribution, which means one of two things. The per developer cost goes up, or if it stays the same, the town has to fund the balance. So the purpose behind this is to allow, change the deem to comply to just basically refer to a right of way in any condition. So even if it's unconstructed, they would be required to access it as a deem to comply. If they don't access it, they wouldn't meet the deem to comply. They'd need to lodge an application for development approval, and we can influence the outcomes that way.
And is there a precedent for that in particular?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of, because most of the examples elsewhere in the metropolitan area, the laneways are constructed. It would certainly be open to the town to charge ahead and construct them all, and then try and collect back as much as possible later, but that would be a fairly significant financial commitment for the town. There may well be merit in doing it because you would better guarantee the subsequent funds coming back later, but that would probably need to be a discussion as part of the next budget cycle.
Just following on in relation to 6.4A and the explanation that we've just received. So that reads, where a site has frontage to both a primary street and a right-of-way identified for retention, so that's clear enough, and obviously it doesn't need to be paved, that's what has been mentioned just now, at least one proposed dwelling shall obtain vehicle access from the right-of-way. Now, when it comes to a single house, does that preclude them from having a driveway on the primary street, or does it just say you have to at least have it from the right-of-way, and you could additionally have one from the primary street, because it doesn't say exclusively?
Through the chair, I'd suggest the inference is you would get, if it was a single house, you would have a single point of access, and if it was a constructed right-of-way, that single point of access would be from the right-of-way. It would be open, though, for someone to lodge an application to have two driveways, and depending on the impact on the streetscape of the primary street, it may well be acceptable, but depending on the house design, depending on street trees, depending on the character of the street, it may not be desirable, but could be contemplated.
Right. Whereas, I suppose in the context of the group dwelling, that makes sense, and you might have configuration of the house as the rearmost would be most convenient to use the right way. But we could be talking about just a quarter acre block, someone decides to not subdivide it or do anything like that, they just wish to build a house on it. We're then saying they have to use the right of way?
Through the chair, that's what this is proposing. And that's what was contemplated as part of the version of the policy that was considered by council previously. If council does not want that to happen, and that's certainly a decision that's open to council, that would have significant implications on the operation of the policy more generally, and more so, probably less about the building development control, but more so on the financial aspects of it. Now, that may well be something council can tolerate, that's okay, but allowing that to occur or facilitating that as the preferred outcome would need to be considered in the context of the financial impact of that setting.
So that could potentially have the effect of shifting people from having a backyard to a front yard. I guess the traditional configuration was house towards the front of the lot, access from the primary street, big backyard. If we got the access coming from the right way, then it would probably flip that equation and you have the relatively small area at the back. Because I can't see a situation where somebody's going to run their driveway through the length of their property to get a house which is situated on the primary street but doesn't have that vehicle access from the primary street. So isn't that really the competition between a front or a backyard?
Through the chair, not necessarily. I suppose it all depends on what outcome council is seeking. If it's seeking that the rights of way remain open and are used, they therefore need to be upgraded appropriately. That raises the question of how that is funded, and it also raises the question of what style of development does it want to see on those sites abutting the rights of way. If council would prefer typical single frontage development to the driveway to the primary street, backyard at the back. It may well be that council might want to review the strategy more generally and may want to revisit the recommendations in terms of keeping some of those rights of way open. I don't think it's necessarily going to be the case that having a rear access for vehicular purposes means there's no backyard. These matters can be designed around. The width of the lots, in some cases, for the avenues particularly, would be sufficiently wide, I'd suggest, to have a rear-loaded garage with a backyard. And if you go on any sort of project home builder website, you can see various designs that accommodate that sort of thing. But ultimately, this is a decision of the council as to what it wants its policy settings to be, and that really needs to be guided by what outcomes it wants. If council wants different outcomes, that's quite fine, and it may well be that the policy would need to change to better deliver those.
But as it currently stands, so single house, quarter acre lot, and most of the towns are 20, so quarter acre lots generally subdivisible, they decide that they get caught by the laneway policy because they have to have that access for the rear. I suppose my concern is, does that then preclude them from having a garage at the front? Because the scenario I would see is where you would probably have people having a garage, maybe studio of some sort, abutting the laneway, and then you might have the more traditional housing configuration at the front. So it would be not saying that people wouldn't have that access, but they could have, in addition to that access, they could also access the primary street. And that's how it reads at the moment. It doesn't say that they have to have exclusive access. It just says that they have to have access from the laneway. So I'm just asking, would that be sufficient to accommodate that where people wanted to, building under the single house, use both the laneway and the primary street?
Through the chair, in that instance, I would suggest we would require an application for development approval on the basis that it didn't meet that provision, but it would be certainly open to the town and or council, town or council, to approve an application based on a design principle assessment if the decision maker was satisfied with the outcome. So nothing in this policy is a hard prohibition on anything, and simply is providing a bit of guidance as to how the R codes are implemented. If someone was to take what is likely to be the reasonably unusual step of proposing two driveways to one house, that could certainly be considered and approved under the guise of development approval.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Councillor
Ames.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Mayor, and through to again, Dr. Gibson, following from Councillor Lithgow's question, and about this scenario where you've got a single dwelling that has a street frontage and a right of way. Would a development application need to be put in to access the dwelling from both sides, but not actually drive your vehicle to the front, say like ATV or a boat or something, just obviously get access from either or on these large blocks? Is that saying that you need a development application to use both of those access points for a storage sort of scenario, or?
Through the chair, broadly, yes. If you look at the R code's provision, the one that's extracted there, I think you'd have to interpret it as trying to discourage, where possible, additional crossovers to the primary street. Because the primary street and the road reserve of the primary street can be used for other things, merge gardens, street trees, bus stops, street lights, whatever else. This is saying, if there is an alternative and more appropriate access to the site, in this case, right of way, use that instead of the primary street.
And
only use the primary street where it's unavoidable.
Sure, okay. And then, so what would happen if there was like an existing crossover at the street frontage? The resident is totally abiding by our policy, as all residents should do. What happens to that paved or bitumen crossover from the street frontage to the boundary lot for the use of whatever?
Yep, through the chair. Typically, I suppose ideally, it would be a case of their proposal provides for the removal of the crossover and making good of the verge. But it may well be that the landowner takes the view that if it's already there, they don't want to incur any additional cost to remove what they think could be a reasonable benefit to the site. In that context, we probably don't have too much of an issue with it, because if the crossover is already there, it is not impeding all those bits of infrastructure that I talked about before. There's obviously no street trees there or lights or anything else, because the crossover is already there. And it remaining in perpetuity is not making the streetscape any worse.
I'd like to comment on that, but then if the resident doesn't have the scenario, well, it's not mine to look after, then the maintenance then comes on the town for us to look after. So I'm thinking, if that is just a pitched scenario, do we then have to bear the cost of the maintenance of that if the degradation of that crossover becomes an eyesore or then it becomes detracting from infrastructure or so on and so forth? And I'm just throwing questions out there that we have to consider.
Thanks. Through the chair, it is the property owner's responsibility to take care of the crossover. That is the policy, but in what the policy says and what the current practice is. There is some improvement we've got to make in that space, and we're planning in part of our improvements with our PATH program of works to include that notification going to property owners to improve their crossovers, which is important in maintaining public safety and not having trip hazards and things like that. So that is something, but we do in our day-to-day activities, when it's bad we go and fix it. So but we need to fix that, and that's part of our strategy going forward.
Yeah, so just one last question. Just in acknowledgement of Mr. Burton's written deputation he provided, he puts forward some suggestions for what he would like outcomes to be. Mr. Gibson, I'm just wondering if you've got any insight into what specifically he may have been suggesting for the policy?
Go on. Through you, Madam Mayor. No, I've got access to the same information as has been provided to councillors.
I just have a question, Mrs. Gibson. I cannot find it now in the commentary that was provided, but I thought I read somewhere a comment about ceding of land to widen the laneway. Can you just explain? Because I know that we had discussions some time ago that not all laneways necessarily, if they're upgraded, need to be a two-way laneway, but some of them could be single in one way in, one way out. And I'm wondering how that might fit with your concepts of upgrading a laneway when those sort of determinations are made.
Through the chair, the issue of seeing of land is touched on page 20. That submissions objected to the need to cede land, whilst the objective 3B of the policy is to facilitate sufficient access from rights of way, including the use of building setbacks or the ceding of land for swept paths for vehicles. There is no requirement in the policy to cede land.
Yeah. Okay, that's... If you were widening a laneway, though, my question is, if you're doing a determination that it would be the best outcome, do those property owners, if they agreed to that, I'm assuming that would be fine. But if you had dissenting views, would there be big problems there, correct?
Through the chair, not necessarily. Or depends what is considered a problem. If it was deemed appropriate and there was sufficient need and nexus between the need to cede land for the widening of the right-of-way and the development that was being considered, it would always be possible for the decision maker to impose a condition requiring the ceding of land with or without that landowner's agreement, but the imposition of that condition would obviously be subject to review to the SAT if the applicant chose to seek that review.
Okay. Thank you very much. Councillor Plifka.
Just following on from that, laneways, is it possible to make them one way where we don't have sufficient width?
Through the chair, that's I think one of the options that have been looked at. Whether that ultimately stacks up from an engineering point of view, and whether the department is comfortable with that approach, that remains to be seen. The department did raise some broad concerns with some of the rights of way being under width and wouldn't guarantee favourable consideration of dedication of an under width right of way unless they were satisfied that the treatment was appropriate. So broadly speaking, yes, that could be contemplated, but ultimately will be decided by the department.
Yeah, and in terms of that, the length of the laneway would have some bearing on that. I mean, if it's only a short laneway, it doesn't really matter if it's one way. But I suppose if you live at the very end of the laneway and you've got to traverse, you know, half a kilometre or so, you're probably not going to be best pleased with that.
Through the chair, I'd suggest that would be a consideration. Similarly, similar fashion to cul-de-sacs, is that cul-de-sacs they can be approved from time to time, but there's a bit of a limit on that. If they get too long, they become undesirable, so I'd suggest the same probably applies to one-way roads as well.
Thank you.
So, councillors, I think we should wind questions up on this item now, because we've got quite a few items to go. If you do have further questions, I would urge you to email them through Mr. Gibson. So we will now go on to item 8.3, which is relinquishment of management order, reserve 37441, which is the Wilson Street car park. Mr. Gibson, if you'd like to speak to this.
Through the chair, as you can see, the purpose of this report is for council to consider the relinquishment of the management order for the Wilson Street car park, and it's recommended that council supports this proposal. Councillors will be familiar with this topic due to it being discussed last week at the councillor workshop. As the report sets out, Minister Carey has recently given an in-principle commitment to facilitate the redevelopment of the site, which is an outcome that aligns with the council-adopted town centre master plan. This is a genuinely exciting opportunity for the town and a great opportunity for council to demonstrate its commitment to a vibrant and active town centre. It will deliver significant promotional and advocacy opportunities that will tie in nicely with the opening of the Bassmean Hotel tomorrow night and the Power to the People initiative starting later this week. And as I say, there's not too much to the report. It's pretty straightforward, and it's recommended that council supports the proposal.
Councillors, questions? Councillor
Plifka. So, say we relinquish the management order and we go through the process, and for whatever reason nothing is constructed on that site. Are we able to build in at the beginning of the process a mechanism whereby the management order would return to the town, just so that we have an area within the town which is being managed, should, you know, for whatever reason, and I hope it doesn't occur, that this construction doesn't take place?
Through the chair, potentially, I suppose that could be communicated to the minister, but I'm not sure what the value would be. Ultimately, under the town centre master plan, the site is not identified as being a reserve to be managed by the town. It's not identified as being a reserve. It's being identified for 8 to 10 stories of medium to high density residential development. So there would be nothing, as far as I can see, that would justify us wanting to have it re-reserved, given that that has not in any way referenced in the town centre master plan.
Well, in terms of the current management of that, so that comes at a cost. So I take it the town staff are currently spending effort in terms of keeping that site looking neat and tidy?
Through the chair, I'd suggest, Mr. Adams might be able to chime in, but I'd suggest there wouldn't be a great deal of expense incurred at the Wilson Street car park.
And if nobody were to tend to that, so say we had the situation where, you know, despite everybody's best endeavours, the building doesn't get off the ground on that site, stay there like for 10 years or so, then is there a chance that we're going to have degradation of that, and we're not, you know, servicing that as we currently are, and the state isn't doing so? What occurs then?
Through the chair, it would be owned by someone, either the state government, typically through the DPLH, or another arm of state government, potentially Development WA or Department of Communities. some entity, individual or arm of state government will own the site, and it would be their responsibility to ensure the upkeep.
And you would expect that they would upkeep it to the same standard that the town currently is?
Through the chair, like I say, it doesn't demand a great deal of resources. It's an at-grade brick-paved car park. I don't harbour any concerns that that would be the ultimate outcome. Obviously, the minister himself has had responded to the town, and if you look at the state government's housing, public housing, homelessness, public transport agendas, you could just not foresee a situation where they would let 3,500 square metres of land in a town centre opposite a train station just sit idle.
Can I just ask a question about that? Because if I understand your perspective, but if there was no appetite exhibited, we relinquish management orders and there's no appetite exhibited to develop that land and it remains in its current state, could the only possible development I could see happening there in that situation then, if they're not going to build housing, would be to charge for the car parking. Is there any way that we could ensure that if they're not going to develop it for housing, that the car parking remains free as we have let it for all our ratepayers? And I'm concerned about if they eventually don't do anything with it and it becomes paid car parking. I'm wondering what you're thinking that won't happen. I can see it on your face.
Through you, Madam Mayor, I suppose my question would be, what would be the problem with that? If it's not town-owned or town-managed, and the town and council has done everything it can to facilitate the highest and best use of the site, if for whatever reason that didn't happen, it would ultimately be a decision of the landowner. The town and council have not a great deal of control over this site. Yes, it's a Crown Reserve. Yes, there's a management order in favour of the town, but beyond that, the town has no real control. We have received a really positive sign from the minister, a minister who is very much motivated to deliver public and social housing, and as part of the government is very much committed to delivering housing generally around public transport nodes. So it would be my strong recommendation that council simply provides this lot via the relinquishment of the management order to the state government to allow them to do what they are resourced to do as guided by council's adopted town centre master plan.
Councillors. Councillor McWilliam.
That's really, Madam Mayor. I'm just wondering whether the Townsend Master Plan might be quoted in any offer of warning statement about revitalisation of the town, except the centre of the town being, you know, sort of the, one of the goals of this council, and that we really appreciate that being fulfilled through whatever development takes place by housing.
Through the chair, we've certainly been upfront with all and sundry about the existence of the council adopted master plan, including to the minister, which prompted the response back. If it is ultimately that council supports the relinquishment of the management order and the cancellation of the reserve, and the state government then takes charge of the project and looks to dispose of it, we would very much advocate from an officer level that the Townsend Master Plan is relied upon as part of the formation of any concepts.
So I have one more question. Some time ago, it's many, many months now, there was a proposal to swap the land out that is down in the Ashfield Place, that this road, still classified as road reserves, but I'm, is it road reserves or what's classified as down there?
Through you, Madam Mayor, Parks and Recreation. Under the Metropolitan Region Scheme.
Okay, but there were some parcels of land down there that you were looking at offering up to the state government in exchange for, so that the land would be a consolidated, for memory, it was going to be a consolidated land lot of parks and recreation, because we have some lots down there that are town owned. So what happened with that?
Through the chair, the proposal was to swap about 10 town owned lots that exist in and around Ashfield Flats that are currently reserved as parks and recreation under the Metropolitan Region Scheme.
Yep.
They're owned by the town Fee Simple, and the proposal was to facilitate effectively a land swap where the town would relinquish those sites to the department to ultimately be Crown land as part of Ashfield Flats in exchange for the town receiving 46, 48 and 50 Old Perth Road being these sites. That is still currently being considered by the department.
Okay, that's fine. Because there was originally some talks about Wilson Street, but that's fine. I do recall now that it was this side here. Okay, councillors, are there any more questions on this one? Okay, so we will move on then to item 8.4, alternative weed control strategies, children's playgrounds. Thank you,
Ms. Davies. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So I'll start off just with a bit of background and then hand over to Mr. Adams. So this report is in response to a resolution of council from last month's council meeting, where council requested that a report is provided outlining alternative weed control strategies to reduce or, where possible, eliminate the use of glyphosate and other herbicides in or near children's playgrounds. So the background section to the report outlines the history of weed management strategies over the past 9 months and the information that's been provided to councillors. There was also a detailed response provided in last month's meeting reports, specifically relating to children's playgrounds. I guess in summary, the overall objective of the town's weed management approach is to effectively control weeds using an integrated approach, and to ultimately reduce the weeds and the requirement for weed control over time.
Thanks to Cole. And through you, Madam Mayor, in attachment one, you'll see the we've mapped all the playgrounds around the town. There's 52 playgrounds at 27 parks and two childcare centres, being Wind in the Willows, Ashfield and Bassendean. Attachment 2 provides further details on the makeup of those playgrounds, and you'll see that the three, I suppose, main playgrounds being Merry Crescent, Sandy Beach and Padbury Way Reserve, Palmerston, yeah, thanks, and Palmerston are our main areas. And what I suppose differentiates them from the other playgrounds is most of the other playgrounds have a limestone retaining wall around them. And the way that operates is within the limestone retaining wall, there's generally no herbicide spraying that takes place, and the herbicide and the weed control is undertaken by mechanical means, either by hand weeding or brush cutting. There is the occasional requirement to undertake some weed control, herbicide spraying, when we've got some inundation of woody plants coming through. And the weed control in Sandy Beach and Merry Crescent and Palmerston does require weed control within the mulched areas, which is within the playground area. This is required because we essentially cannot control the weeds within those areas without herbicides. We cannot control them with brush cutting or hand weeding. And I suppose to provide an example, it currently costs us $7,500 to control weeds at Palmerston, Merry Crescent and Sandy Beach. The estimated cost of that, if we were to go without herbicides, would be tenfold. So that would be in excess of $75,000 a year. And we would be looking at, I could guarantee that we would end up with poorer outcomes because we won't be able to control the weeds. So a change into our current practices will result in financial and reputational risks, and that do not appear to be appropriate given the current policies and procedures in place to mitigate risks and the low level of herbicide use. And along with that, limiting weed control within methods to these options would impact upon the infrastructure in the area as well, in the curbing, the footpaths and the structures that we've got in place. So the recommendation of the report is for the town to continue with its current approach for weed management in or near children's playgrounds, which involves minimising use of herbicides where possible and maintaining the town's assets in a safe and usable condition whilst demonstrating financial responsibility. The officer recommendation also recommends an annual report being provided to councillors to provide an update on the town's weed management, including or near playgrounds.
Thank you. Councillors, questions? Councillor Carter.
Thank you. My question is to you, Ms. Davey. This recommendation says no change at all. This is what we've done in the past, and this is what we want you to continue to do. Am I right?
Through the chair, it's recommending we continue with our current practices, which is to continually look at options to reduce herbicide use. But in principle, because the current use is very low, it's only at 3 to 4 locations out of the 52, and that we manage the risk appropriately, that we continue with the current approach for those areas, yes.
No, that was just the question. That's, in other words, no change to existing practice.
Can I just ask the sites that are mentioned, Sandy Beach? Well, let's just mention one, Sandy Beach or Merry Crescent, one of those. When you do treat herbicide treatments in those areas, I'm thinking Merry Crescent. I'm trying to think how close that would be to the actual play equipment. I'm trying to get a visual on that in my head. So,
Yes, thanks, Madam Mayor. That Merry Crescent and Sandy Beach is quite different. Merry Crescent being under a lot of trees, not being heavily re-ticked, doesn't have as significant kaikui or couch growth. Whereas Sandy Beach, which has been reticulated and has been the grass has been flourishing for many years, does have significant kaikui and couch growth. So the usage of herbicides at Merry Crescent has reduced over the years because we've kept it under control. And we're envisaging a similar approach for Sandy Beach, where we will turn off once the native plants are established within the garden beds, we can turn off the reticulation. That will reduce the kaikui and couch growth, and then we can. But as long as we keep it under control with herbicide spray, then we can reduce the herbicide spray over time, and that's the. The point of Ms. Davies' recommendation to continually monitor, continually reduce herbicide spraying, and follow up with further recommendations to council each year.
So would I be correct, Merry Crescent, though, there's less there, but also would I be correct in assuming that the play equipment is located further away than where any potential spraying might occur? But at Sandy Beach, again, trying to get a visual on the actual planted areas. They're like little islands of planted areas between different play sections. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's correct, Madam Mayor. But I was trying to highlight that the Kaikui and the Cooch is already there.
Yep.
And it's okay. Just buried at the moment. It'll come up.
Okay. Councillor Plifka.
You mentioned there's 54 odd playgrounds, and the standard configuration is the little limestone retaining wall and then filled with sand, and that seems to stop the weeds from growing. In respect to Sandy Beach, if we were to continue to use glyphosate until we had completely eradicated those two grasses that you mentioned, if we then surrounded the entire playground by a similar physical barrier, a limestone wall, something of that nature, would that then solve that problem? Or because they're grasses, are we going to continuously see the grass seeds blowing on the wind and establish, or are we only concerned about the rhizome sneaking in and then sprouting up?
Yes, thanks, Councillor Plifka. Yeah, through you, Madam Mayor. Look, it's something that we're going to have to monitor and address. The way we've controlled it at Mary Crescent is just by the odd spot spraying. So I don't think we'll get to the point where we can totally eradicate all herbicide spraying, but it has been significantly reduced over the years for Mary Crescent, and we're forecasting that the same approach with Sandy Beach will occur.
So for those two very difficult sites, so I mean of the 54 playgrounds, we have to close two of them for a period of time. If we were to close those for some prescribed time, is there a half-life for glyphosate? Does it degrade into something else, and after a particular amount of time you can say, well, there are no traces?
Did you want to take that one?
There are figures on that. However, it's not linked to the time that you need the signage installed for or when it's safe to access the area. So the label instructions say it can be accessed after the product's dried, and so the signs are usually left up for a few hours after the application has been completed, but the degradation time would be much longer than that. But it's not linked to the time when the playground needs to be closed.
But potentially, I mean, we could signal to people the difference between the two, and they could decide for themselves as to whether they wish for their children to enter the playground.
Through the chair, I think the time would be quite variable depending on the situation, the type of environment, and it could be quite a lengthy period of time, so months, for example.
Yes, so there were people that were particularly concerned about it, and I mean, that's their right, they can be concerned about it. If you then said to them, well, we've sprayed on this date, they'll come back in a month, 2 months' time, and it won't be a concern. It's just so that there is that choice in the community, whereas other people might be more than happy to abide by the standard, which is, well, as soon as it's dry, it's safe for use. Okay.
Councillor Plifka, I think what's happening here is we are moving into some of the operational areas of the organisation in respect to their spraying techniques and the frequency.
I suppose I was trying to focus more on the community side, that people could be informed and make their own decision, but I'm happy to leave it at that.
I actually understand where you're coming from. But I could actually also travel into that area as well, because I'm wondering if there are alternatives to actually spraying when you've got weeds in these garden beds. I think there was wicking tools, but I don't know if that would work or not. I'm just curious. I think you're probably using the terms, the things that you want to use and work anyway. It's difficult. Councillors, I think this is a difficult one because there are clearly aspirations to reduce herbicide use within the council. And we've built playgrounds, nature-based playgrounds, which are very much desirable in this area. So it is a very difficult one. And as the staff have indicated, a significant volume of the playgrounds would not necessarily receive any spray within a certain distance from the play equipment. Councillors, I don't know, has anyone else got any other questions on this one? No, okay, so we'll move on then to the next item, which is 8.5, the RFQ for streetscape weed control services within the town of Bassendean. It doesn't rain, but it pours.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I've a little bit of intro for this one because it's a bit of a complicated process, so hopefully councillors can bear with me. It's following the presentation of an amended streetscape community management strategy, council back in March, by Ms. Bailey. A formal RFQ was advertised in June for streetscape community control services. The RFQ was advertised with separable portions for steam weed control and chemical weed control. The purpose of this report to council is to recommend that council award a contract for steam weed control to Green Steam Australia and for chemical weed control to Environmental Industries, as mentioned in the report. It's recommended that council award the contracts for 1 year only, with an extension option of a further year at the town's discretion. And a report will be brought back to council prior to the town exercising any extension option. And the budget for streetscape weed management control at the time of issuing the RFQ request for quote was within the CEO's delegated authority. And that's why it was issued as an RFQ as opposed to a tender. However, the proposed contract, the Green Steam, exceeds that authority and indeed the tender threshold. Now that's why the matter is before council tonight for decision, or for decision next week. The amendments made by council to the recommended strategy in March had the effect of shifting the vast majority of streetscapes from chemical to steam treatment, and the responses to the RFQ show steam treatment to be approximately 6 times the cost per linear metre and 10 times the cost per square metre of chemical treatment. The report also asks that council note that a small additional budget will be required for the current year, which will be sought at mid-year review, and a larger increase in the budget will be required for 2023-24. Despite the higher expected costs, it's really important, I think, for council to note that without these contracts, we'll be unable to manage weeds in streetscapes. Process. Any technical questions in relation to the actual treatment processes can be answered on this day.
Councillor
McLean has some questions. Yeah, I've got 2 questions. So, first of all, one about the actual process. So, you mentioned that when we got the pricing back, it exceeded. So, am I understanding correctly that it should have been a tender process rather than an RFQ? Is that what you were saying?
Through you, Madam Mayor. It's appropriate for it to be an RFQ because the budget at the time and the anticipated cost of the works at the time we went to market was below the tender threshold.
Okay.
So we are compliant with the regulations in that regard.
Okay, yeah, that was my question.
However, given the higher than anticipated cost, it's not within the CEO's delegated authority to actually award the contract.
No, that's fine. It was just whether there was an issue with the process. And my second question, in the report it refers to the request council has made in the previous resolution for the annual report about the weed management and streetscape. I'm just wondering whether the intention is to also provide feedback on how often spot spraying was required on the streets that have been treated with steam, so that there's some indication to council about despite the decision not to use herbicides on the streets, but the provision for spot spraying, just so that we get a sense of how
we're actually still requiring the herbicides to be used.
Yep, through the chair, yes, that's correct. We would also be continuing the photo monitoring of all the types of treatments, so we'd have a comparison between the steam treated areas and herbicide treated areas as well.
Councillor
Plutka. So, renewing this steam weeding for a year, at the end of that year, do you think you have sufficient evidence, information to be able to decisively say whether or not the steam weeding is being effective?
Through the chair, we have previously assessed it over a 12-month period, so we do already have that information. This will provide more of a comparison between the streets that are treated with herbicide compared to those treated with steam, which we haven't had previously.
Yep. So we expect at the end of that year to come back before us, and then we can compare the two and then make a decision as to what we want to do going forward.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. So we would award just 1 year of the contract initially, which should go from October 2022 to September 2023, and we would present that report to councillors before we'd consider extending the contract.
And, I suppose in terms of an operational issue, you know, we have to now approve a higher amount. Does that then re-enliven the discussion on cost, and what would be the cost of purely relying on herbicide?
Through Madam Mayor, the budget increase required should Council award these contracts for the current financial year is very small, primarily because of the time elapsed during the financial year, so we missed the first treatment already. So even with one less treatment, there'd still be a small increase in budget required. And should to send you to the contract, there'd be a need for a further and larger increase. The cost of treating the streetscapes with a chemical treatment instead of steam is dependent if it's an area or if it's a pathway that's sort of measuring a linear metre, but it's about 1/6 or a.
Yeah, I think we said 6 to 10 times. So, yeah. In any event, we'd average that out, call it 8 times, and that's a large amount of money. Yeah. What does that actually work out at? So, if we were to depart from that, what would be the additional amount of money that the town would have each year?
So, through the chair, that's actually included in the report. It's between an extra, I think, $90,000 to $100,000 per year based on the per square metre or per linear metre distance.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor,
just in answer that the question that Councillor Plutka asked was about reigniting the discussion on the town's approach to weed management on the streetscapes. At this stage, that would require a rescission motion of the previous resolution. And if that occurred, would it be possible for the town to then just award a contract for herbicide treatment on the all tiered roads throughout the town?
So the current resolution of council requires steam weeding until the 30th of June 2023, so it has an end date, and because of the way the contract has gone out, we couldn't vary it to that extent based on the current contract. It would have to be a completely new contract.
Yes, through you, Madam Mayor. The reason for that is variations to contracts need to be fairly minor in nature, and that would essentially require the contract for chemical treatment to increase probably tenfold, so it wouldn't sort of be satisfying the regulations to actually engage in the contract variation to that magnitude.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Okay, councillors, if we've got no more questions, we'll move on to the next one, which is 8.6, parking restrictions, Parkwood Street and Lock Place. And
through you, Madam Mayor. This report is for council to consider the parking restrictions in and around Harcourt Street in Bassendean. As the report sets out, in early 2022, the town received an increasing number of reports regarding allegedly hazardous and illegal parking in Harcourt Street. from the intersection of West Road to the end of the cul-de-sac. These complaints prompted an informal street meeting on site where residents were able to discuss the matter with town staff and councillors. From there, the town undertook formal consultation, which is discussed in this report. The consultation identifies that the majority of residents believe that some change is required. However, there is little consensus on what that change should be. In response, staff have assessed the various options and it is recommended that council pursue the use of a yellow-lined restrictions on the southern side of Harcourt Street. It is open to council, of course, to determine a different restriction or make no change at all.
Thank you.
I've got a number of questions. So in the report, it refers to 79 and 79A West Road as having no stopping located out front of it. I'm just wondering why that area is not able to use the parking.
Through Madam Mayor, because of the restriction that council have previously imposed, but if council was to want to open that up for parking, that council could use this report as a vehicle for the removal of that restriction.
So that's a long-standing restriction that's been in place for
a long time? Through Madam Mayor, that's my understanding. I believe the painted restrictions were faded and were recently repainted, so that would suggest it's been their actual restrictions have been in place for at least a little while.
What would be possible to get some information on that during the week? Also, we had some discussions at the site meeting around the area adjacent to the school that's got the yellow hashed road markings that I think they use for the Kissin Drive, but then the rest of the day is often not parked on because it gives the impression that it's permanently not able to be accessed. Do you familiar with what I'm referring to? Was there any consideration given to how we might be able to better utilise those parking bays during the times outside for school drop-off and pick-up?
Through Madam Mayor, broadly they are able to be used.
I appreciate that, but I mean what we've currently got there tends to mean that that space isn't being utilised. Like, is there an alternative way we could designate that for the Kissin Drive, but that makes it more accessible to people outside those hours?
Through Madam Mayor, potentially. We have to check what the specific sign restrictions are, and it may well just be something as simple as informing people that they can park there. If the signage restrictions are satisfactory and they require no change, maybe it's just a bit of education for the people in and around that area.
Okay. I get the impression that the road markings themselves are probably part of it. And sorry, thanks for your tolerance, but my other question was, obviously Lovelock Place has been included in this report as well, and it's great to get feedback from those residents, but my read of the report is that the feedback that we got from the residents there will be used to guide any future decisions if there's a problem on Lovelock Place. Considering that at the moment it's not really, or there doesn't seem to be a problem, would the intention to be, if a problem is identified, that we would actually go back and re-ask? Because I'm just imagining people would be more likely to engage if there's a problem rather than at the moment when there's not.
Through the Chair, that's correct. This was, I suppose, just simply to sort of benchmark the impact, because we were fully sort of cognizant of the fact that if you make a change somewhere, it has a reaction somewhere else, and we just wanted to get a feel for what the status quo was, noting that Council could make a number of decisions in terms of Harcourt Street, and we wanted to make sure that we were pretty open and upfront to acknowledge that there could be some sort of downstream impacts, and to get a better handle on whether there's any major issues at the moment. But obviously, if Council resolves to apply some enhanced restrictions in Harcourt, we'll obviously implement those restrictions, but also at the same time sort of monitor any changes that might be occurring in Lovelock.
So this parking issue, I think there were potentially two causes of that. I guess you've got the last crime, which is wildly popular, and you've got the school, which also...
Wildly popular.
Well, when you get those two things, I mean, one of them's essential, the other's a school. Now, do we target the parking restrictions to when both of those institutions are operating?
If they close, and after both of them are closed, then I would assume that you would probably want to open up parking to people at that stage, because it probably wouldn't be as high a demand, and it would only be, one would presume, people visiting other people after those hours, so probably social visits as opposed to visiting neighbours there rather than going to the school or to the last room.
Sorry to do this to you, Councillor, but could you please repeat the question?
Yes, so just outside of those hours, so the school, the last crumb, are closed, so that the restrictions wouldn't apply outside of the hours that those two institutions were open.
Through the Chair, yes, that is an option to Council, not the one we're recommending, but certainly it is open to Council to have signed restrictions, which are more particular with the times of day where parking is permitted.
And then the rationale for outside of those busy times was just to make the signage easier, or was there concern about what was happening outside of those hours as well?
Through the Chair, the view was, I suppose, in terms of the installation costs, go lines are the easiest and cheapest. In terms of the regulatory function, they're certainly the easiest to police. And the fact that if there was a reduction in demand, the impact of the yellow line is less acutely felt. Whilst the restriction would apply 100% of the time, it's really only having a material impact when there's demand beyond the northern side of the street and the carrying capacity for vehicles on the northern side of the street. If at certain times of the day demand more broadly is lower, the impact of the yellow line will be less keenly felt.
So that could be, I suppose, a convention would establish over time, the residents would understand when they would be less likely to receive a parking infringement than other times.
Through the Chair, if it was a yellow line, it's a no stopping at all times. So there is a blanket prohibition on parking. So they would probably learn reasonably swiftly. But obviously it's open to Council to, if you want to be a bit more bespoke with the restrictions, that would lend itself to be either timed restrictions and signed restrictions and or permit parking. Both of those are discussed in the report, and there's obviously implications in terms of the cost of policing it, but certainly within the scope of Council to pursue, as long as Council understands what the implications are.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, councillors. Councillor Ames.
Real quick, thank you, Madam Mayor. Through you to any of the executive panel. Any current numbers of infringements that have been placed on, residents in the area with the current yellow lines that have been installed? Any knowledge of that?
Through you, Madam Mayor, that would be my area. None that I'm aware of. Not that I've necessarily been made aware of every restriction. I can certainly find out during the week.
Yeah.
But as we previously said, we try and take a sort of education-first approach,
yes,
and a punitive approach secondary to that. The yellow lines are very, very clear. And people genuinely understand that you can't park next to a yellow line, so we find we get pretty good compliance, but I can certainly come up with a specific number during the week.
If it's going to put you out of your way, please do not. But if you've got your fingertips, we're going to be fantastic. Come on.
Okay, so councillors, we'll move on to the next item, which is 8.7, review of Town of Macedonia Corporate Business Plan.
Thanks, Madam Mayor. So the purpose of this report is for council to consider the outcome of the review of the town's corporate business plan. It's a requirement every year for council to adopt the corporate business plan aligned to the budget settings and priorities set by council. So officers have reviewed the corporate business plan provided, a draft to councillors via the bulletin, firstly on the 29th of July, and then we held a workshop with councillors and we went through each of the projects and actions within the corporate business plan, and then it was recirculated on the 19th of August for any final comments. If there's any questions.
Councillor McLennan?
I apologise because I acknowledged those opportunities, yet when I looked at it I had a few questions, so
certainly.
I apologise. There were a number of things where there was a project identified to be developed. So, for example, there's the public open space strategy, the public health plan, the secondary concept plan for Sandy Beach, but then in subsequent years there didn't seem to be I noticed some of the other projects there was the open dot to indicate that the intention was to implement something but the funding hadn't been allocated. I'm just wondering if there was a reason why some of those other projects just had the planning work but without any intention flagged for implementation in the following years.
I'd be happy to have a look at those specific examples if you like.
Yeah, okay, I'll have a look, and if there's any others I'll send them through. I was just curious. And there were a couple of other things that were included in there, like just let me find them, sorry. Things like facilitate Reg 17 review, review the delegations annually. I was wondering if there was a reason why those specific things, which seem to be BAU really, were incorporated into the corporate business plan when others may not be.
They have been historically,
okay.
But they will happen in any event because they're part of our compliance calendar and part of our audit program and so on, so they certainly don't have to be in there.
Yeah, just more sort of reflects all the work that everyone's doing that goes on behind the scenes, which is great.
Definitely.
And one final question, if you don't mind. There was, and Ms. David, you're probably going to tell me you've already explained this all to me before, but the one on Objective 7.2, the River Park Interpretation Node by a partnership with DBCA Rivers Journey Project. Can you remind me what that was? I don't remember. It sounds fantastic, which is why I want to know about it.
Through the chair, so DBCA have identified interpretation nodes where they can co-contribute funding towards interpretation and seating. So it's to look at that option, for that location.
Excellent. Thank you.
I was just going to say too, in response to Councillor McLennan's comments, we are reviewing the strategic community plan at the moment, which sits above the corporate business plan. And one of the observations of officers has been that our strategic community plan is very broad, and so we do have a number of priority areas, and compared to other smaller local governments we do cast a very wide net. And so sort of thinking about how we might want to sort of construct our next SCP, and obviously this will cascade from that.
Yeah. Well, my first question about some of the ones where there was the plan that didn't have subsequent follow through, like I was interested to know if they were ones that the administration identified as maybe delaying the implementation for that reason, or whether it was just that it hadn't been incorporated. So maybe during the week, if I can...
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Councillor Lifka.
Use an example, if I find that the easiest. So page 23, we're talking about of the report itself. Yes, it's 143 of the attachments. So we've got the project actions, and some of these are a little bit expensive. So we've got upgrade lighting at Bassetty Noble, upgrade lighting at Ashfield Reserve, renew Ashfield Flats boardwalk. So those are pretty big, expensive items. We've got them all slated for 22-23, save for the Bassetty Noble, which then extends to 23-24. So just using that as an example, if all of the things we say we're going to do in a particular financial year were to be done, would we have the funding to do so?
Some of these priorities also rely on grant funding. So certainly the Bassendean Oval, the Ashfield Lighting Upgrade, and I can't recall...
The boardwalk, the Ashfield Flats boardwalk. So.
Thanks to you, Madam Mayor. That's two-thirds funded by the state government. So I think that's 93,000 from memory, and 60,000 comes from state and 30-odd from us.
Just in terms of the document as a whole, so everything we say we're going to do in 22-23, if we manage to do that, would we have the funding available to execute all of those projects? So has this been fully costed on the latest figures that we have?
This has been costed against our budget priority. So based upon Council's approved budget, we have gone and reviewed the corporate business plan and updated it to reflect those priorities of Council.
The priority, in terms of the priorities, how are those ascertained? Are they the latest resolutions, or is it at some stage a process whereby a decision is made that, you know, perhaps one project gets deferred so that another can be executed in a more timely fashion?
That was the planning process, the planning budgeting process. process and extended from February through to July when the budget was approved. So through that process we had several workshops where those priorities were determined, and once council approved the budget we reviewed the corporate business plan and updated it to align it to the budget.
Yeah, so if we continue on with this, then we're saying this is funded, so any departure from there, whether that increases expenses or decreases them, would obviously increases not possible, but decreases, then that funding would be available for other projects if they became a priority of council.
Certainly, and so we use the quarterly report and also the mid-year review process. So if there are some budgetary adjustments that may need to be considered by council, that would be the appropriate time to raise them.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, councillors, if we can move on to 8.8, adoption of draft council briefing session policy.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So this item is seeking council to consider whether to adopt the draft council briefing session policy and also to repeal the council briefing session guidelines. The item emerged from a notice of motion at the July ordinary council meeting where council resolved to request the CEO to provide a briefing documents policy that provides for the briefing agenda documents to be provided to councillors one day earlier, so on a Wednesday rather than the current schedule of a Thursday, and also ensure that briefing agendas include all items proposed to be considered by council at the subsequent OCM, with the exceptions of the monthly financial statements and items of an urgent nature addressed under the meeting procedures local law. The draft policy seeks to codify the present system and seeks to also provide clarity on specific procedural matters such as public question time, statement time at the briefing session. Councillors were provided with the opportunity to provide comment on the draft policy. I guess the area that drew most comments was in regards to public question time and public statement time and deputations, and their alternate views presented. One being that an amendment to the draft policy be provided to provide the presiding member with the discretion to allow for members of the public to ask questions or make statements on any matters not included on the briefing session agenda. And we certainly considered that request. It wasn't included in the draft policy based on the following reasons. Firstly, the briefing session is not a formal meeting of council. It's not addressed under the meeting procedures local law. The purpose of the briefing session is for council to ask questions about items on the agenda and for the administration to provide a response. There are no minutes taken at the briefing session. The briefing session is an informal forum, and it's acknowledged the briefing session sits outside the Act. There are other forums and opportunities for members of the public to ask questions or make statements on matters concerning the business of the local government rather than what's on the agenda. Thank you.
Councillors' questions? Councillor Plifka.
Yeah, just in terms of that, and I understand that for the briefing session it's just that, it's the ability to ask questions. Say, for example, though, that a community member, if we had it would be somewhat controlled. I mean, they couldn't just turn up and ask about anything. But if there was a matter which was of, general interest or importance to the community, and a community member, for whatever reason, hadn't agitated that through other channels, hadn't picked up the phone, sent an email, turned up on the night and asked a question which then perhaps prompted a councillor to draft a notice of motion then for the ordinary council meeting to respond to a rapidly evolving situation, then would that not be something which would justify allowing them to ask a question of that nature?
No, the time frame wouldn't permit that. So I think it's a 10-day rule for a notice of motion, so it wouldn't be dealt with until the following month in any event. So if it was raised at a briefing session.
But that could then contract it to 1 month as opposed to 2 months, I suppose.
But I guess if there was a matter of an urgent nature, community members have access to their councillors at any time. And I guess the question is the briefing session forum, which is designed as a question-answer opportunity for the administration and councillors. Is that the appropriate forum? And I guess that was in the mind of the administration in drafting this policy.
Okay, thanks.
Councillor McLennan?
Just on the topic of question time and statements, there's a number of clauses in the policy that make specific reference to the two being separate entities. At present, like for example on page 4 of tonight's agenda, we have public statement time and questions on the briefing agenda combined as one. So would the intention be to change that so that they're separate items to avoid that confusion?
Overlap.
Yeah.
Certainly we could separate that out on the agenda, you're okay. suggesting?
Yeah, yeah, I think that'd be helpful. And so for example, whatever, 3.3 public question time, it refers to the total amount of public question time not to exceed 45 minutes, but then we don't have a corresponding clause around public statement time. And I'm just wondering, if we're separating them out, we may need to
separate
look at that.
Yeah.
Another question as well, sorry. Oh, at the moment, the policy is silent about deputations and whether or not someone is able to give a deputation at both the briefing session and the council meeting. And I think we've had discussions where the assumption is it will be one or the other unless there's a significant change in the interim. But I don't think at the moment there's anything in here that... So I'm not sure if that's something that the staff would support, including...
And I will have a look at that
yeah.
in terms of what's in the meeting procedures, local law as well,
okay.
just to make sure that they speak to one another.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Councillor Politica.
Just following on from that, if they are separated, we would have the question time first, because then a member of the public could ask a question, which might temper what their statement might look like.
Thank you.
So can I just ask some questions on that as well, because we've had frequent times where a person will lead into their question with a statement, and I'm interested in, from a timeline point of view, would it not be more efficient use of time, like we've done tonight, to have questions and statements together? Because if that person is already up at the microphone, is leading into their question with a statement, then I'm asking about the efficiency of time. Because if you separate them out, are we not actually creating more of a timeline thing here, where we have to get them up twice, have to advise person that, you know, you're making a statement, this is not the right time to make a statement. I'm curious about the practicalities of this, given human nature.
It probably comes down to the presiding member in yep. terms of how the meeting is chaired, but also providing clarity to those that participate in the meeting as well, and ensuring that they're clear, because there sometimes is an overlap, an emerging, and it sometimes makes it very difficult for not only the presiding member but also officers as to whether there's an expectation that the comment requires a response, or whether we're just noting, whether councillors are just noting as well. So I think it's about providing that clarity up front in terms of the structure of the meeting, and to ensure that people participating in the meeting are aware of, I guess, the sort of protocols around each of the agenda items.
So that will then bring me back to another question on human nature, and whether we're actually going to be so rigid. For instance, we had a gentleman here some weeks ago who had turned up to a briefing expecting to be able to ask a question that was not on the agenda. And I permitted that question. So on the basis that I didn't wish to see that person have to go home and then come back the following week to for meeting to ask that question. So I'm curious about how we operate as a council. Again, are we creating a rigid atmosphere where it might be easier from a timeline point of view, again, to just deal with things there and then? That I'm just curious about the administration's point of view on that particular one, because that was a case in point some weeks ago.
And I do recall that gentleman, and there was probably incorrect advice provided to that gentleman as to why he came to the meeting to ask that question. So I think that was probably an isolated incident. But it's also about, council's reputation as well in terms of managing meetings, providing order, particularly where there are contentious matters to be dealt with as well, and providing some structure and rigour around the order of proceedings, but also some clarity in terms of protocols and expectations in terms of standards as well. Tonight's agenda is not always indicative of future agendas, and there may be matters that are contentious and highly emotive. And so having structure in times like that actually helps council to get through the agenda in an orderly way.
Councillor McLennan? So I'd just like to clarify, because my understanding is, obviously this isn't a local law that you have to abide by, I would imagine that if it is adopted as written, that it is something for council, and in this case largely the presiding person, to take into consideration, and it guides what we would like to see happen. And the presiding person, in an instance like that, where there's not many people here, it's not going to take up a lot of time, still has the ability to say, yes, in this instance, but we've still got something to
Absolutely.
Guide what it is that we intend to happen. So there would
Absolutely.
Be nothing to prevent the presiding member.
So the presiding member still has discretion in terms of how the meeting is run, how the briefing session is run. And if it is a quiet night and there's not much on the agenda and somebody turns up accidentally, there's provision for that.
Any further questions, councillors? Okay, we'll move on. Audit and Governance Committee meeting, 7th of September 2022. Do you wish to speak to this?
Oh, I'd love to.
I'm just checking. That's
my favourite meeting in the corner. Quickly. the report's pretty self-explanatory. The audit committee considered three items. The only thing I really wanted to bring to the council's attention tonight was that the committee recommended an additional point to the officer recommendation for the first item, which was the general's financial audit results for local government for 2020-21, in which case we believe there is an error in the attachment to the report. There was town not providing its financial statements by the statutory due date of the 30th of September, and we did, and the committee recommended the council that an additional point in addition to what's recommended to the committee to the CEO to write the general to incorporate some justice principles prior to publishing what the final one report.
Thank you. Very short and sweet. So, councillors, questions? Councillor
Plifka. Just if, perhaps, obviously, being on the Audit and Risk Committee, if you could explain what that error was and how that did, I suppose, undersell the timely execution of work by yourself and all those in your team, and how...
Certainly, through you, Madam Mayor. Thanks, Councillor Plifka. So, the statutory requirements for the... initial statements or trial balances we call to be provided to the auditors by the 30th of September each year is the start really of the audit process, the annual audit process. We provided the information to our auditors on that day, and we were actually quite proud to have done so, given that we had not managed our finance for some time, and current manager of finance had only commenced in the town a few weeks prior, so it was a pretty great effort, I think, by our small finance team to actually comply with that requirement. And so it's in attachment to the Office of the Auditor General's report, which has been tabled in Parliament. It states that the town was not non-compliant in that regard. So we believe that is an error. We have actually pointed that out to the Auditor General. The resolution or the recommendation to the committee was that the committee shall be more formally. And then the committee said, I guess, adopt an additional recommendation with a view to trying to stop this type of error occurring in the future. Which, in effect, would hope have the Auditor General at least bring to our attention and the other local governments prior to finalising our report and taking it in Parliament, such that there could be a process whereby you might be able to provide some information in any sort of areas like this might be corrected before the report's finalised. So that was the additional recommendation from the committee. Thanks, Councillor, for the opportunity to, I suppose, just reiterate the council. It was a bit of a tough time for the town in terms of its finance team, and it's a positive reflection on them that they actually managed to get the job done on time. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your answer, and thank you for ensuring that compliance, even though you didn't get credited with it. So, look, we all understand that you've done the right thing there, so thanks for that.
Thank you. Councillor
McClem. Can I just ask, I think at the meeting you mentioned maybe Joondalup was one of the other local governments who were affected. I wonder if we know which others may have had a similar situation so that we could maybe approach them and say, would you also like to put some weight behind this request?
Yeah, we have had some informal discussions with some other local governments, but sorry, through you, Madam Mayor, we can certainly pursue that further.
I'm not if it's going to take up a lot of time, but if it was something that was easily... information was easy to obtain, but...
Yeah, I don't think it would be overly onerous. I think, the other local governments are highlighted in the report, like we are, so, I think that's certainly something to
do. Councillor Ames.
Yeah, very quickly, through Madam Mayor to Mr White. Is that a verbal name and shame within Parliament, or more of a tabled document that also names and shame for the local governments that don't, submit their... On time.
Supposedly.
Through Madam Mayor, I'd suggest it was fairly deep into an attachment. It attached to a fairly lengthy report, and we may have been the only people that noticed it in the context of the town of Bassendean, but I suspect that other local governments, if they are in the same position, I would have noticed it in their respect as well. But I don't. Attention at the time of the table or anything like that. And so there were some other local governments that were specifically called out in the body of the report for some more significant or serious failings. And so that certainly wasn't the case with the town. It was in an attachment. We were coded sort of orange instead of green in the column in terms of the provision of the information by the due date. So the casual observer probably wasn't particularly noteworthy.
And I'll pop it alone for those that are not privy to the ramifications of such orange coding. What does that, I suppose, earmark the town with not supplying documentation on time of that calibre?
It can affect the timing of the audit. It didn't in our case because we had supplied the information, and also I think we worked well with the appointed auditors. But I suppose if it is provided late, it's not compliant with the Act, and it can affect the timing of the audit, which can also affect the timing of when Council adopts the annual report and the annual electors meeting. But essentially, it's on record at the moment that the town hasn't complied with the statutory obligation.
Okay, councillors, if we can move on now to 8.10, proposed terms of reference, Arts, Culture and Events Committee, and this would be Luke.
Through the Chair, this report is prepared at the request of Council. So it's to facilitate the establishment of a new arts, culture and events committee. The draft terms of reference were provided to councillors via the CO bulletin on the 12th of August with a copy of two responses. If council maintains its desire to establish a committee, it is recommended that it adopt the attached terms of reference, noting that any committee will represent an additional burden on administration and other competing priorities may need to be delayed or discarded.
Councillors, question, Councillor Carver.
Yes, I'm interested to know why there wasn't more community involvement considered in the terms of reference. If we haven't the machinery to hold this particular committee, why aren't we involving more of that people?
Do you want me to answer?
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Sure.
I think, Councillor Carter, that comes back to the way I framed the original notice of motion, with an intent to initially commence a councillor-only type a committee, with the premise that once that had been established, that that committee could potentially then establish working groups of community groups, which means that that is a less it means that working groups could be more structured around project minded type things. But this comes back to the committee themselves and how they wish to proceed, and I didn't want to create too much of a large structure without learning to walk before we run, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Any other questions, councillors? Councillor
Plifka. Just to administration, I know there was a statement that this would increase cost, drain on administration's resources. Is there a way in which we can, I suppose, piggyback this meeting onto other meetings? So, for example, this evening we had the half an hour beforehand a special council meeting. Would that assist administration if it was sort of within a block, as opposed to, I suppose, having another day and bringing people in at 6 o'clock at night and then continuing through? Is that sort of something that would assist in that regard?
Through the chair, probably not, no. Right. No, it'd be an additional workload that's not currently provided for, so whether it's a separate meeting or a back-to-back meeting, it would have little benefit.
All right.
Okay. Councillors, if there are no other questions, we'll move on to the last report, which is 8.11, accounts paid 31st of August 2022. Shall we just go straight to questions if there are any questions, councillors? Okay. I believe that there are no notices of motion. I don't believe there's any confidential business, and that would bring us to the closure of the meeting at 8:36 p.m. Thank you, everyone.
Sure.
Interesting.
All right.